Hi, it's me. Welcome back to the show. How's everybody doing out there? How was your week? Was your week good? Good. Back with a guest. Got a guest again. We're back into the regular flow of the show. Geez, right before I started recording this, I was flossing and brushing as I do. It's Monday night. I'm about to go to bed, and I was like, let me do the intro and outro to the podcast, then I'll go to bed. And as I'm flossing, a crown that's not, I don't think this crown is 9 months old. I think this crown is probably around 6 months old, just popped right out. And so I've just got a big hole in the right side of my mouth. And that makes two. No, in the left side. So I've got a big hole in the right side where there's a tooth that was extracted a while back that I'm waiting to get an implant in. And now I have a big hole in the top left side. I just feel, I'm like, I'm running out of teeth here. It's ridiculous. I'm 34 years old and I've got crowns that are popping off and teeth that are getting taken. It's, I don't know what to do here. I need better bones, people. Evolution needs to step it up, okay? We need better bones. Like there are certain things that evolution has done right, but like, just the fact that, I mean, I talked last week about anxiety, just the fact that anxiety is just sort of an evolutionary mechanism of like the fight or flight response from just a way old bygone era where I'm like, it's, I don't need it anymore. So it's just constantly coming on and being like, should I be scared of something? Is there something to be scared of? And it's like, no, dude, I live in a climate controlled apartment in a very temperate area. And the threats that I'm facing are like, yeah, a big earthquake could hit at any time, or like Russia could nuke the town that I live in because like I live in one of the cities that Russia would nuke, but I can't control that shit. Or the Yellowstone volcano could go off, but that's all stuff that's just sort of like every day that could happen. There's no point in me walking around being afraid of it all the time. I don't need this constant fear. You know what? So it's that. And then it's also that like, hey, evolution, how about humans need to have stronger feet? You know, the apes that we branched off from on the evolutionary chain, they kept strong feet, tough, strong feet that can handle shit. I got these toes. If my toe hits anything, if I'm walking around barefoot and my toe brushes past something, it's a big problem. It'll ruin my day if it's bad enough. And then the last one is teeth, dude. Come on, evolution. Come on, the bones that I use to eat things, the bones that I use to consume food, food that if it gets stuck in there can grow bacteria, they gotta be tougher, dude. They gotta be tougher. They can't just be falling apart. And I take care of my teeth. I floss and brush twice a day every day. I use mouthwash. I'm rinsing this shit. I'm like, how are these supposed to last another 30, 40 years? These teeth. Anyway, how you doing? How's it going? Let's get to the show. Parker McMullen Bushman is on the show. Parker McMullen, but it's her second time being on the show. We love Parker. If you don't know, Parker is Queen Work on social media, at Queen Work, spelled K-W-E-E-N-W-E-R-K. Last time Parker was on the show, we talked about dismantling white supremacy. And this time we're talking about critical race theory. Okay? At some point I'll have Parker on the show to talk about something that's not race related, you know, that's, but because Parker is very knowledgeable in lots of things, but it's something that she is very good at talking about, and she talks about a lot on her platform, on her social media and stuff like that. Parker's great, funny, intelligent, and just a good time, good hang. We're talking about critical race theory. You've heard of it. If you're not completely aware of what it is, you know that it's a thing that Fox News talks about a lot, and that just in general is in the news a lot. You know that it's a big voting point, that a lot of people on the right are voting right now because they're afraid of critical race theory. They've been made to be afraid of it. So we will be talking about what critical race theory actually is, what people think it is, the laws that are being made around it, and just sort of in general what that all means and portends for where we are currently at, as the American populace. I think that's about it. So we can just jump right into this bad boy. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'll be talking with my friend Parker McMullen Bushman about critical race theory. Thank you. I'm so glad that you were available to come back, and I've been wanting to have you back on, and I'm glad that you could make the time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah.
I always enjoy chatting with you.
I always enjoy chatting with you as well. So this will be nice. I wish we could have gotten you in the month of February. I should have done it. And whatever, we're right outside of it. It's fine.
Man, do you know, look, people have me busy all February.
I bet.
Yep.
And like, we don't need it to be February to.
It could be any other time. I'm actually really glad that you brought me on in March. I'm still black in March, so we can still.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It's interesting. It almost feels like this topic is already getting kind of like old hat. Like it's already like there have been a lot of people who have done videos on it. John Oliver just did a full episode on it. And it almost feels like it was like last year's big debate topic on the political stage. But I think that it's still going to be an issue that's going to inform elections going forward. And that like all the way through to 2024, I think this is going to be a big like stump point is this issue. And so for anyone who's listening who like doesn't already know or who is still like confused by why this is, let's try to just on the outset like very in layman's terms rudimentarily define what critical race theory is.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Like what it actually is or what people are trying to say it is.
We'll do what it actually is, okay. And then we'll say what people think it is.
Okay. I think that's great.
Yeah.
So, okay. Critical race theory, right? It's an academic, like college level concept. It's not new or new. I mean, newish, like it's been around 40 years. I'm 43.
It wasn't invented in 2018.
Wasn't invented in 2020, right?
Yeah, right.
The core idea is that race is a social construct, right? And that racism itself isn't like a product of just individual bias or prejudice, but it's also something that's embedded into larger systems like legal systems and policies. So critical race theory kind of asks that question of why racial inequality endures and persists within systems, even decades after like civil rights laws have passed. Why is it still enduring, and how do we contribute to actually breaking it down and abolishing it?
Let's talk a little bit about the term social construct, because we hear this in regards to like gender too, when we talk about gender politics and things like that. Like gender is a social construct, race is a social construct. I think that concept can be a little amorphous for people sometimes. Like, like what does that mean when you say social? Like, let's talk about that a little bit. How race is a social construct.
Yeah, you know, so race, like, does race, are racial differences real differences between people? Like, we're not different species, right? We're all Homo sapiens. And the differences in how people are treated based on their race is that social construct, right? So we would like, it would be great if there were no differences, right? It would be great if people really acted that way, if societal systems really acted that way. But because society has been built in a way that takes race into consideration, and that social construct, cultural construct around it, right, is what it is. So the differences for race isn't like a real thing, right?
Right. Yeah. It's. I feel like there's even been studies done that have shown that there is more genetic similarity across racial lines than not. That it's essentially you strip away external markers, things that, you know, like physical traits and things like just things that people have on their faces. And, you know, whether like I have a mole on my cheek up here, like take away all that, strip us back down to our what's in our DNA, our skeletal structure, things like that. It's all pretty similar. And and we're sort of arbitrarily making the amount of melanin in someone's skin sort of a marker of this thing called race, when we could just as easily make it about any other trait. We could make it about like blue eyes, or about what color hair you have, or what kind of hair, curly hair or not curly hair. Like it's all of the, but we make it arbitrarily about this one thing, about how melanated
and
your skin is.
And we have so many other things, right? That make us who we are. You're totally right. It could be another feature that we're like, oh, blue-eyed people and brown-eyed people, and y'all are all together, and you're all together, and now we're going to create societal structures that's based on that thing, right?
Yeah. So the idea of race, the idea of the white race and the black race, and like and Asian as a race, or AAPI, you know, like it's societally created. It's invented. Yep. It's an invention of society to categorize people. And what purpose could there be to categorize people into different groups if not to structure things in some form of systemic hierarchy, you know?
Exactly. I mean, it's what needed to be happen, what needed to happen to help, especially in the U.S., chattel slavery, right? There had to be some reason that this group of people, you know, could be kept in this way. That type of slavery was so different from the way slavery had been done any other place, right? Mm-hmm. And people think about, they're like, oh, but there's always been slavery, and there's always been this and that. But with the type of slavery that we had in the U.S., suddenly you could not get out of it. You could not rise above your station. There was no way to pay it off. People who came, your family went into slavery, and that had not been before. Like, you could, even if your father was a slave, it didn't mean that you were automatically a slave, but they made it so. And they said they had to build this like system and this talking about Black people and who they were, right? To say that they deserve to be in this position. They deserve to, like, they had the physical build for it, they had the body for it, and now they had the marker of it, Black skin. So we knew who was supposed to be a slave, who wasn't supposed to be a slave. And we, like, it's an easy tracker, like, look for the skin. And that built a whole society on that, the way we thought about it, because people didn't want to give up that free labor. Right?
Yeah. And it's interesting the way that, and the narrative has shifted over time to fit whatever it needs to fit to keep that system still in place. Like, the narrative was at the time of chattel slavery that, like, people from this continent with this skin color are naturally docile and naturally obedient, and like their natural place in the order of the world is to be subservient to people who are naturally more take a leadership role. And then once there started to be that like national divide between the North and the South, and slaves started to escape and stuff like that, they came up with, I can't remember what the term is, but it's the psychological sickness of slaves who would run away, and they would, do you know what it's called?
Yeah.
And they would say, like, oh, you have this like mental illness where you're compelled to run away.
You're compelled to be free.
Yeah. You're compelled to, yeah. And it was, so that was a narrative. And then once, people were free after the emancipation, or free in quotation marks after the Emancipation Proclamation, there was this narrative that like Black people were extra aggressive and very scary. And so we need to arrest them a lot, because the way that slavery was made legal was through the 13th Amendment, where you can enslave people. And so now all of a sudden it's like, oh, the narrative used to be that they're extra docile and obedient. Now the narrative is they're extra aggressive. And, you know, so whatever the story needs to be to fit.
Yeah, whatever it needed to fit.
Yeah.
Whatever it needed to fit.
Yeah.
And you know, have you read, let me stamp from the beginning. I just want to tell folks, like, this book is just amazing by Ibram X. Kendi. I've got the book, but I also have the book on tape, which is what we're listening to. And it's super thick, but it tells, like, from the very beginning how that social construct began and all of the little places along historically that, you know, shifted slavery into what it is today, shifted slavery into what it became, and then how that still is throughout today, like the way that we interact. And it's amazing. Such a good writer. People should check that out.
Yeah, because stamped from the beginning. I also want to throw in there Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents by Isabel Wilkerson. Do you know that book too? It's the study of like caste systems, and she goes into like the origin of the social construct of race and like the creation of that. So yeah, absolutely, people should check that out. I also wanted to talk about this idea of the way that so the narrative keeps evolving, but you were talking about how critical race theory is the academic study of how and why these things continue to persist. If we have things like the Emancipation Proclamation, and then if we have things like the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s, how could these things still persist? And, you know, we talk about the shifting of the narrative, where like the narrative now is that we'll see. There are no laws that are inherently prejudiced anymore. So if these communities still continue to struggle, it must say something inherently about this community.
Yeah.
And then it's just the moving of the goalpost. But I want to talk
You know, that idea, right, is actually really important to talk about, because we see it like in the US, we like to say, you know, oh, there's this clear line between people who are racist and people who are not racist. And along those lines, we also like to do it along political lines as well, right? And it makes us feel, if we're liberal or on the left, that maybe we don't have those thoughts. But something that's really cool in that book, Stamped from the Beginning, is that the idea, or maybe it was, no, I think it's in Stamped from the Beginning, or it could be in Becoming an Anti-Racist. But the idea that Blackness was inferior, right, was built into, like we've talked about it, the slavery, everything. And now today, when we look at communities that aren't thriving, right, there is that still thought on both sides that Blackness is inferior. And on the right side, it's like, well, people just need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and do better and really ascribe to the tenets of whiteness, but we don't call it that. And on the left side, it's like, well, we'll provide materials for people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, or for, you know, we'll provide college for you to go to so you can get to be more like what polite society is, rather than an evaluation of the way the systems are built that reflects whiteness and says that the way that Black people show up in spaces are inferior, and so that we have to change them to adjust to the system as it is, rather than change the system to realize that there's lots of different differences in the way that people show up. And there's nothing wrong with Blackness, right? There's nothing wrong with the way Black people speak. There's nothing wrong with the way Black people create or think about the world or whatever, but you don't honor within your system the way that Black people show up. Instead, you say, we will give you the tools needed to show up better in our system that we have created.
Well, yes. And I think it's really hard for people to see that, especially white people. I think it's hard because a lot of these laws and systems are structured, especially in the last 50 years or so, but really over the last a couple hundred years, since people have been trying to fight more for examining and breaking down these systems. Every time there's opposition to these racist systems and institutions, they're restructured in a way that's a little bit more cleverly coded, or just so it's hard to see that it continues, but it's always restructured in a way to be like the 13th Amendment going, okay, slavery is now illegal unless you're in prison. And if you're in prison, then you can be a slave. So what we'll do is we'll invent a bunch of laws to break, like loitering, or just, we'll just sort of drum up all kinds of charges on black people that are out in the street in a town where we don't want them to be. And then we have legal slavery that we can continue with. And we got chain gangs and stuff like that. And so, and that has continued all the way up till today, which is why the study of critical race theory is so important in the form that it's in, is like actually looking at the way that laws are structured to show the reason it's written this way is to look like it's saying this while doing this.
Yes.
You know?
Ooh, you dropping it. Yes.
You know what? So, okay, let's talk a little bit about that's, so that's sort of a rough sketch of what it is in the academic.
What are we talking about? What is critical race theory?
Right. Yeah. That's a rough sketch of, I think, a decent rough sketch of what it is. Let's talk about a little bit about what it is being portrayed as, or what people might think it is who are voting based around this issue.
Yeah, you know, it's become a boogeyman, and really a boogeyman for people who are just, they don't want to have the conversation. They're not willing to examine the systems. They're not willing to see how those things impact right now what's going on. Like, they want to pretend like it is in the past. Right. And so if you are unwilling to talk about the ways that it affects people today, then, you know, critical race theory is, you know, becomes a boogeyman. And people really feel, who are against it, I think, feel that it is a divisive discourse that is pitting or saying, you know, putting people against one another, and is saying, you know, putting people of color against white people, and causing division. But the reason that it's causing division is because people don't want to have the conversation. So if you are told that things are still going and you don't want to see that, then, you know, it can feel bad because you don't want to make the changes, and you don't, and if you don't want to make the changes, why talk about it?
Yeah, it's this thing where, and again, the conversation on the right, as far as I can tell, is being framed in this way where it's like, critical race theory is teaching kids that white people are inherently superior to black people, that black people are inherently inferior, that they are inherently separated, that white people are inherently hateful and bigoted, that, you know, like all this stuff where I'm like, you know, and the language isn't clear enough in how they define it, because it's like, well, we are talking about systems that have been set up to favor whiteness and to put whiteness in an inherently superior position in this system. So we are talking to a certain extent about that, but you're framing it in a way where, like, you're taking away all the nuance to it, all the detail of, like, literally talking about the way that a system was created and structured to create that. And you're just saying that all that's happening is teachers are just going, did you know that white people and black people are inherently different, and that there's nothing that we can ever do to change that? It's like, it's such an oversimplification and perversion of what it actually is.
And no one's teaching that in fourth grade, fifth grade. This is a college level.
That's the other thing is it's not happening. It's not happening in elementary schools. Yeah.
Like, they're saying what it's a catch-all boogeyman for any type of anti-racism or anti-whatever talk, you know, like, if we want to talk about racism, that, you know, we can't do it, right? Because it's critical race theory. Yeah. And that's not what critical race theory is, right? Teaching kids to get along with one another, answering history. Like, they've made it so that teachers feel uncomfortable answering history, talking about history, right?
That's
like, what?
I mean, that, like, you said earlier that, you know, people like to think, oh, well, that was then, this is now. Like, why do we have to live in the past? That's not happening anymore, even though it still is. But people like to think that. So I go, okay, let's even just say that you're right. Let's say that that is just the past and that we have fixed it, and that Barack Obama being elected president was the proof that we really did fix it once and for all. And we live in a post-racial society now. Let's just say that. Wouldn't it still be beneficial to examine our history to make sure that we're aware of mistakes that were made? It's so bizarre, because what they're really trying to do right now is they're actually trying to get rid of any mention of America's racist history and America's racist present in the classroom at all.
And if you can't have those conversations, then you can't see the ways that it is impacting today, right? If you can't have the conversation about redlining, right? If you can't have the conversation about how the government literally drew lines around areas deemed to be poor financial risk, which were explicitly due to the race of the people living in those areas, that led to areas that were uninvested in, disenfranchised, didn't have amenities built in, didn't have grocery stores. They were turning white people that wanted to build in that area away, right? You can't build here, we'll give you the money to build in a white neighborhood. They were not giving black people the capital to be able to build in their own spaces, or giving them like really awful loan terms that they could not keep up with. And then when we look today and we see those same areas that have been, given to the wolves, like they let anyone kind of build up in those areas. They let, I think I lost my, oh no.
Did you lose your live stream?
I lost my live, wait. Thing came across my page and I was like, send that notification. Okay, so like when they were not letting black people build in those areas, we get to the present and we see that we have underinvested areas. We have areas that do not have grocery stores. We have areas that now they're letting factories come in because they were underbuilt areas, and the people who are living in those spaces have higher instances of, all of these health issues, right? And so like all of these things piled up because of this past issue. But when you do not know all of that history, right, all you can say is, oh, well, black people live in areas that are not, not great because they choose to live there. They choose to live there and be all together, right?
Here's the really pernicious thing, and I'm glad you talked about redlining, because redlining is one of those examples of like legislation and policy being created where all of the language was, and it was like thinly coded, but it was all coded. Like when redlining was first made a practice, rarely was it actually what they didn't really break it down by saying like white neighborhoods, black neighborhoods, but it was very, very clear in the language that was being used what they were talking about doing. Like it's very, very thinly coded. But it began, it was all part of that process of like, well, we'll word it in a way where anyone who reads it literally, we can just go, we're just talking about districting. That's just a thing that happens. We're just breaking things into districts by economics, by which places we think are best to invest the money in and stuff like that. Not saying explicitly that we are intentionally divesting from communities of color and investing in white communities, because if a black family wants to bad enough, they can move into a white neighborhood and they can find a house, even if they're turned down by several realtors that they're trying to work with who say, we don't want to help you find a house here. If they want it bad enough, they can get in that neighborhood. And if a white person wants to, they can move into a black, like there's nothing like explicitly in the law separating these communities. So this whole nature of crafting policy and writing laws in ways where you're not saying the thing, you talked about examining, like, if you don't know the history, that it's all of these things building up. I think the more pernicious thing is the fact that, like, as far as we can tell, laws like this are still being written with that same kind of coding, which means that there are still people who are knowingly protecting white supremacy in our laws today.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, it's just under the surface. And it's, you know, it is so insidious. And every once in a while, it peaks out, right? Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, people are like, no, wait, this is a racialized thing. This is based on this. And people will wish it away. People will say that's not the case. People will really try to hide it while on the same side saying, I'm not racist. I believe all races should, you know, everybody should have these opportunities, but not in my neighborhood, not in my backyard. I don't appreciate these folks, whatever, whatever, right? So
I want to read a little bit of the language from this law in New Hampshire right now that is surrounding critical race theory. There's a lot of laws popping up in places like Arkansas, Idaho, Iowa, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Alabama, Florida, Utah, Virginia, and Georgia, and Arizona surrounding the ban of critical race theory. But it's not just critical race theory. That's the thing is, first of all, we've already established that like when politicians on the right talk about critical race theory, they're rarely, if ever, actually talking about the actual definition of critical race theory as the college-level academic study of laws and systems and the ways in which those have informed racial relations in the United States. They're rarely, if ever, talking about that, and they're usually just talking about anything, any curriculum in the K-12 level that addresses race at all. So I want to read this and show how it's written in a way where you could see how that seems reasonable. Like a reasonable person could go, I don't see what's wrong with that. And we'll talk about this a little bit. But the law says it bars teaching that people of one age, sex, gender identity, sexual orientation, race, creed, color, marital status, familial status, mental or physical disability, religion, or national origin are inherently superior or inferior to people of another. So that on its face, you're like, yeah, we shouldn't teach people that anyone from one thing is inherently superior or inferior just as like a like morally or ethically, like as a, but it's such vague and intentionally vague language. And vague language intended to sound very reasonable, but we have to define what we mean when we say inherently superior or inferior, because if there are systems in place that favor one group over another and make one group systematically superior or inferior, we have to be able to talk about that, right?
Exactly. And, you know, it's so reminiscent of Trump's anti-DEI training bill. And, like, I do diversity, equity, inclusion, justice, and accessibility training for a lot of organizations and a lot of federal organizations as well. And he created this policy that said that basically banned any type of training like that. It said any training that makes someone feel bad about their identity, right, is would not be allowed. And it had, you know, all sorts of different criteria for it. And it's so interesting because, you know, I know people feel bad. I know people feel bad. They hear about this trauma. they feel bad. But I really think that what bills like that and things like you just read were created to not have the conversation, because we feel bad when we don't feel like we have a recourse or when we don't want to make change. When we feel like there is a motion forward and that we can, that we're trying to be part of the solution, then I think it changes a little bit how people come to this conversation. Mm-hmm. But they're so like, don't make anyone feel uncomfortable. Well, We've been feeling uncomfortable. Black folk been feeling uncomfortable for lots of years.
Yeah.
Like, we can have this conversation. Y'all could be uncomfortable for a minute. Let's just talk about it.
I mean, first of all, I just want to talk about the irony and the hypocrisy of, and this is just true with so many things that the right kind of gets twisted up about, where they, you know, they talk about cancel culture and they love canceling things. They talk about censorship and free speech, and they literally burn books. Like, they are literally in 2022 are holding book burning rallies. Like, it's wild. Like, book burners have never been the good guys in history, by the way.
No,
like, ever. And then the other thing is, like, they love to make fun of the left and you know, progressives for safe spaces and the idea of safe spaces, where, like, I've talked about safe spaces before, where it's like, I think safe space is a misnomer. I think it's usually thought of as like a place where no one will ever be uncomfortable, and it's actually not true. A safe space is a place where you can have uncomfortable conversations in a safe way, and with the knowledge that everyone will be there with the goal of trying to understand the issue better, and no one will be there to intentionally dismantle or cause further pain or dismantle the conversation. I mean, derail the conversation or stall or anything like that. And it's so funny because they're so against safe spaces, but then they literally are introducing legislation around critical race theory. Like you said, that in the legislation, it says that, like, anything that makes a child feel uncomfortable shouldn't be talked about in the classroom. And it's like, well,
yep.
Well, I mean, first of all, vague language again. And second of all, there's just so many things that you have to learn about as part of your education that are uncomfortable. And like you said, people of color have been uncomfortable in school, you know, and in the world, you know. So if you need to be uncomfortable for a little bit just to learn about it, to learn about the way it got this way, I mean...
And we can do so much better, right? That's the big thing, but not if we don't have the conversations. And it's amazing, you know, I do, like I said, I do these trainings all the time, and people are floored, right? When I start bringing out the statistics and we start talking about, one, how our country is demographics are changing so quickly, right? By 2023, our demographics that are 18 and younger will be half will be minorities, right? So we've already hit that mark in our country demographic for those 18 and younger. And by 2050, our white demographic will be about 46% of our country demographics. White males, right, make up about 30% of the population. But when we look at presidents, right, we only have one. I love Barack. When we look at presidents, if we look at the CEO, like Forbes top 400 CEO level positions, when we look at our National Senate and Congress, right, all white males are like abundantly over it, like 90-80% represented for 30% of the population. And that is an issue. Like,
this Supreme Court appointee, this appointment where everyone's freaking out about the fact that it was that there was a point made to make it a black woman, and they were like, "What an insult to how, you know?" And it's like, what are you talking about? When 99% of Supreme Court justices that have ever existed are white men, what are you talking about? Like, how could you possibly have the audacity to complain about that and then try with a straight face to say that, like, that's not a racist position to take.
And we've gotten to the point that we can have the conversations about women, right? And women in, well, white women in spaces, right? If you say, we're all men and we got to figure out how to bring a woman into this, people can understand that a little bit more. But race is still such a, like, sensitive topic, right? And I talk about systems. When we think about systems, right, privilege shows up as having a system that is designed with you in mind.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so when I talk about, when I give that example, I usually use, even though people are so ableist and people are so like, disability community has a really tough time in our society, but people understand some of those examples more. So I talk about the building that I grew up, which had stairs everywhere, stairs up to the front, stoop, long, narrow mm-hmm. hallway, whatever. That space was built with me in mind, probably by an able-bodied architect sure. building a space for other able-bodied people. And I never realized when I was in that space running around as a kid, totally fine, running upstairs to a third story walk up, right? Didn't have any problems, right? I didn't realize how a person who used mobility equipment, right, to get around, how much harder or impossible it would be for them to be in that space.
And just the right? amount of things in our society that are designed without them in mind, that are just
without
sort of like,
mind,
just,
right?
just sort of like, hey, look, you're such a, like, sorry, the majority of people who are going to be using this building don't have the issue that you have, and I can't
yep.
make concessions for you. And, you know,
exactly. And so having those spaces, like when I make that example, people can see it. They're like, oh, yeah, okay, space built without you in mind, an able-bodied architect and blah, blah, blah. And when I say think about wider, apply that widely, right? Who built the Constitution? Who built all of these policies within our society? Who were the architects? And were they building these systems for people like them, right? When with people like them in mind or people like me in mind, right? And we know the answer to that. So when you walk through a space, when you walk through society, and when you see these disparities in who has access, who has money, who can own housing, who has jobs, who, like all of these things that are skewed along racial lines, we have to look at who the system was built to uphold for them to go through, you know, easier, and who was not built, you know, who was not thought of when that system was created.
Yeah. And, again, you know, God, I hear it from people all the time, arguing with people about, you know, people who will pop into the comments section or something like that, who will say, like, you know, America is no longer a racist country. Like, we don't, and they'll say, like, point me to a single law that that says it's illegal for a black person to do something, and it's not, you know, and it's so interesting that they can't, or they won't engage with the nuance of, like, the way that laws are carried out, first of all, the way that
yeah.
the way that justice is at, justice, quote unquote, is actually handed out in America,
yeah.
and also that so many people in the voting community, people who are not in positions of power, really have it's worked on them, this trick of structuring the language in a way where it doesn't explicitly say what it's designed
yeah.
to do.
Yeah.
But we know,
yeah.
I mean, you have to use critical thinking too in this process, because it's like, okay, why would people who are writing legislation like this, anti-CRT legislation in schools, why would they go out of their way to use such vague language that sounds so reasonable? And why, like, what is the goal here? Because we know that largely the thing that they're talking about being afraid of, where, like, it makes white kids feel bad about themselves and stuff, it's largely bullshit. Like, I don't know if you've heard this anecdote that gets trotted out a lot by politicians and by pundits and commentators on TV. It's this story of, like, a little white girl who comes home from school and tells her mom, like, today, am I a bad person? And her mom goes, why are you asking that? And she goes, today at school, they taught me that I was a bad person because I'm white. Have you heard this anecdote? That?
Oh, I have not.
Oh, it is like, everyone tells this story, and no one can give a source of where the story's from or what it is. People have tried to track it down to be like, I want to find who this little white girl is in this, like, that everyone's talking about.
Yeah.
And as far as we can tell, it's just a made up story. It's just a hypothetical scenario of, this is what happens if you allow the boogeyman of critical race theory into schools, is this little kid will feel bad about themselves just for being who they are. They misquote Martin Luther King and say that we're supposed to be judging people on the content of their character, not the color of their skin. And this little white girl was judged on the color of her skin. And, you know, and it's like, it's this made up story. So you have to go, okay, so if they're making up the reason, if they're lying about the reason, what's the actual reason?
Yeah.
And you start to get to understanding that, like, these people are well aware of what the power structure is and how it was built, and their yep. job is to maintain it. And yep. they know that if they maintain it in with explicit terminology and say, we want to make legislation that makes sure that our systems still favor whiteness over blackness, that won't be popular. They know yep. that that's an unpopular way to sell the idea.
And we've, like, come to this point where that's exactly what it is. You can't look at the demographics. You can't look at the disparities and say that these laws and not talking about it isn't about keeping white supremacy going, right? People are feeling, they're like, oh, we're being replaced, right? We're being replaced.
They're saying it. They're talking. It's a big talking point in white supremacist communities and just on yeah. the right in general. The population shift. It's a big, yeah.
And it's shifting, yeah. y'all. It is. And it's not that you're being replaced. There are spaces. If you look at our population and you look at who is in leadership, these are spaces that you have stolen from the people.
Yes.
These are spaces that, you know, you're not being replaced. You're holding a space that you should not be in, right? And just take your representative share and allow people to be and to speak and to share their experiences, right? When I look at organizations, I work with some organizations that are like, you know, we want to bring people in. We've got these positions that they don't turn over very much. And then when we look to hire people, we just can't hire or find any qualified people of color. And we don't want other people to feel like, you know, they're being left behind because they deserve spaces too. Y'all already got all the spaces. Like,
yeah, it's that thing where that quote that's like, to people who have experienced privilege all their life, equality can look like oppression. Like it, yes. like it. I mean, to go back to your metaphor of, you know, a building that was designed with able-bodied people in mind, adding accessibility to that building, adding ramps, adding an elevator that is easily accessible for a person in a wheelchair, adding things like this doesn't actually take away from the experience that able-bodied people have with the building.
Yeah.
It's an illusion to, and it's another one of these lies that's sold to the voting populace that, like, if our population gets the statistics get skewed, that means that eventually we will be the ones who are subservient. And it's like, I don't think anyone really wants to switch the power dynamic in this dramatic. We're just trying to get to a place where we no longer are operating under systems that are built on a made-up construct like race, which we've already established was a made-up societal construct.
Exactly. Yeah. And people aren't looking for revenge. And I think that's the other thing. Like, folks think people of color are looking for revenge for, you know, the last hundreds of years.
Yeah.
But that's not what it's about. And equality is not revenge. And I think, you know, we got to look at these systems. Like, it is easy. You're right. Like, we can put a ramp on a building. We can do an elevator, right? But some of these buildings just need to be torn down
yes.
and rebuilt.
Yes.
Rebuilt with everyone yes. in mind, right?
Yep.
And like, we have to, like, we can build something new together. And for some of it, I think some of it can be retrofitted, but really we need new systems. And people are so afraid to tear down and rebuild. They want to keep it exactly like it is, and we will add this little doggy door that y'all can come in on, right? But otherwise, we're going to try and keep it the same. And it could be so much bigger. It can be so much more amazing. We could build something that just really is collaborative, really has everybody represented and bring everybody to the table. But that does require getting rid of and not clinging so hard to the original blueprint, because it's not the best blueprint.
Yeah, there are definitely systems that I think could benefit from being taken down altogether and rebuilt as something different. Policing is definitely one of them. That I'm like, that thing is just an old, dilapidated piece of shit building that was never good to begin with and was built built with corrupt contractors and bad materials from the start. And we keep putting duct tape on it, and the thing needs to come down.
I am loving this metaphor. I'm loving this metaphor. Here's the next part of this metaphor.
Yeah.
And we can willingly hire a construction company that we all agree on to come in and dismantle and rebuild it. Or y'all can wait too long. We're just going to burn that shit down. We're going to burn it down.
Yeah.
And then build it like, you know, stop thinking that if you hunker down long enough that we're going to get to keep things exactly as they are, that don't have enough, that does not have the representation needed. Because people are getting so angry. People are getting so tired of waiting because they've been told again and again and again that the systems are going to be retrofitted and they have not been working, that the building's going to have a new alcove that is going to do a new thing and it's not working. And if the system is so broken that is not working like that, you wait long enough, people are going to take things into their own hands, and then y'all get mad at that, but you had fair warning. So
my friend Carlton Bluford just wrote a play called The Cleanup Project that was just got its world premiere in Salt Lake City, and it's a play about a hypothetical scenario in the future where black people have an uprising and they take over the country and they take over all of the systems of power, and they're basically in charge and they're running the streets, and white people are kind of running for their lives because there is implemented a new president who comes up out with this policy called the Cleanup Project, where they decide that they just need to get rid of white people because they just can't they just can't be, you know, trusted. And it was a really interesting,
Austin, we'll let you stay Austin.
I get to stay but I was watching it, and I was kind of struck by this thought where I was like, you know what? It's actually pretty amazing that something like this hasn't happened, because I was really struck by, like, it's fucking phenomenal, the humanity of marginalized communities, that they're like, it's amazing that marginalized communities aren't going, nah, fuck this. We're fine. If you guys won't respond to all of our bids for diplomacy and all of our bids for humanity and empathy and reasonability, then we might just have to do it by force. And I think it's pretty amazing that hasn't happened, but it seems
what's the name of the play again, Austin?
It's called The Cleanup Project, Carlton Bluford wrote it, and
wow.
Yeah. Hopefully he gets it published at some point. He gets it, you know, gets a few more productions of it, because it was a really thought-provoking and interesting and challenging piece where, you know, initially you're sitting there in the audience going like, oh, well, nothing like this would ever happen. And even if it did, like, you know, good people wouldn't stand for something like this. But then you're sitting there watching it going, I don't know, though. The argument that some of the more radical people in the play are making is they're like, we've tried everything else. We've tried everything else many times in many different ways. At what point do we just go, hey, you know? But I feel like that's sort of what white supremacist leaders are always girding their loins for, is they feel like that's what's coming. They feel, it's so interesting, because I just want to go like, hey, instead of, you know, bulking up your armory, and instead of like constantly finding new ways to reword the legislation, maybe just like, agree to a ceasefire and put the weapons down and just come to the table, and there doesn't need to. So dead set on there having to be some kind of conflict over this, because
it doesn't have to be.
Yeah,
and that's what, like, people get in 2020 when there were the riots happening, right? And folks are really upset. They're like, "Oh, you're burning your neighborhoods. You're doing this is not King's dream, and you know this and this and that, right?" And just this thought of, you know, people being pushed, like when they've tried every other tactic, you are not listening, and they are just so angry. And if you are not willing to listen when people are nice about it, right, there is no reason for people to continue trying to be nice about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
exactly.
And so, yeah. Yeah, anyway.
So the last thing I want to say about this, too, is I feel like if there's any listeners maybe skeptical or who are thinking like, well, how do you know that it's language that's being disguised intentionally for some nefarious, they're like, how do you know that people aren't just worried about the thing that that law said, where it's like, we just don't want anyone being taught that. And I just want to address really quickly that, like, this isn't speculation. This isn't like, I'm not being speculative about this. Like, I think what they're doing, they've said this out loud multiple times. The reason why critical race theory is the issue that it is right now with voters and things like that, and with politicians, is largely because of a guy named Christopher Rufo, who has stated multiple times on TV shows and on his Twitter page that the goal was to weaponize this term, was to make this term sort of a catch-all for anything that they don't like, that they could go, if we can get our voters, if we can just tell our voters anything that we don't like is critical race theory and have them know that's bad, then we've succeeded. And he has said as much. So again, it's kind of like the whole thing of people being concerned about the population and stuff, and being concerned about becoming a minority and that whole thing. It really tips the hand, and it's also like, it's not secret. That part is, that's the quiet part out loud.
They're saying that out loud. And, you know, we're up to, you listed off the states, we are up to like 14 states that now have these laws restricting how school districts can talk about racism and even sexism,
right?
And it is, they're really trying to denounce any anti-racist education that shows up. And if they, you know, if people are feeling like, oh, well, how do you know? Then why aren't we addressing the laws with language specific to people who face discrimination, right, and are marginalized and face disparities, right? They're not using that language to talk about the ways Black kids get bullied at school. Right?
Yeah.
They're not using that, like, there are so, like, my kids come home, my kids are mixed race, right?
Uh-huh.
And they come home, they're having racial conversations. They're having kids say things to them about their hair, about all of these other things. And so, like the example you gave earlier, the little white girl unicorn that they're using, right? Those conversations are already happening among kids of color, right? And kids of color are already having uncomfortable conversations because their white friends and other kids are saying things that are inappropriate to them about their race.
Yeah, that's the ironic thing about that made up anecdote that everyone keeps using, is like, that's an actual story that's been happening for generations with little Black kids going, you know, is like coming home from school and being like, how come I'm being treated like this at school?
Yep.
And like, that's an actual thing that and so much of the language around pro, or, you know, the people who are trying to ban quote unquote critical race theory in K-12 schooling, and it never is actually critical race theory, but the people who are trying to ban it, it's almost always explicitly for the protection of white students. And they say it, like, it's the quiet part out loud. Like, they are not shy about being like, we don't want white kids to feel uncomfortable and to feel like they're being unfairly targeted by this curriculum. And I mean, I'm going to read one more thing here from, this is from Richard Corcoran, the Florida Education Commissioner, who said it was important to police teachers to make sure that they are not indoctrinating students with a liberal agenda. He said, "I've censored or fired or terminated numerous teachers. There was an entire classroom memorialized to Black Lives Matter, and we made sure she was terminated."
Wow.
I mean, it's like they're not even really being subtle about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
This is 2022 that we're doing this, that we're burning books and that we're banning curriculum and that we're banning, firing teachers for saying Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the attacks on critical race theory really have nothing to do with critical race theory.
Right.
Instead, they're targeting any teachings that challenge dominant narratives, any teaching that yes. are anti-racist, right? Any teachings that talk about the country's history and identity. And we have to realize that critical race theory isn't being uncomfortable about racial conversations, mm-hmm. right? So we can't call that like blanket thing. It's not critical race theory. And we do need to be having these conversations because it's how we move forward, right? And it's how we are able to bridge those gaps. I think that there is a lot, there is division. And I think about, but not brought on by having the conversation. The division comes from not being willing to talk about these things that are affecting people's lives and livelihoods in a really real and impactful way. And if someone doesn't care about how my race affects how I move about society and experience my life, then I feel like they don't care about me, right? As a Black woman. But when people are willing to have those conversations and are open to it and are willing to say, you know, this is a different perspective, but let's talk about it, right? Then that's when I feel like you see me and let's come together. I want to see you. I want to connect. I think that this is where we can start to build community around those experiences and understanding of one another.
Yes. Yeah. Here, here. Cool. Anything else you want to talk a little bit about? What's going on with your business with Crystal and stuff? Because there's been some moves there too, haven't there?
Yeah,
last
yeah,
time we talked, okay. We talked about yeah.
Oh, I love this. Okay, so for anyone who doesn't know, so my name's Parker McMullen Bushman. Did we do that introduction? I'm Parker McMullen Bushman, and I have a tech startup, right? My tech startup is called Inclusive Guide, and basically it's like Yelp, but for inclusion. And so people can go to the guide. The guide is open right now. Go to inclusiveguide.com. We need people to sign up for profiles, and you can rate businesses on whether or not you felt safe, like physical, mental, emotional safety there. Did you feel welcome? Did you feel like you were treated with dignity and respect? Did you feel celebrated? Was your identity celebrated within that space? And what are things that, you know, good experiences, but also things we want to help businesses be more inclusive, right? So what are ways that we can give them that information? It's called the Inclusive Guide, and it's not just for Black people, right? A lot of people call it the modern day green book, but it's for everyone. It's for everyone who, you know, might have experiences out in public. It's for anyone who wants to support inclusive spaces and know the right places to go to. So we're excited because it's out there. We're still in beta, but anyone can get on it and tell us when you come across bugs. We got some bugs, but I invite anyone. Yeah, go make a profile.
That's very exciting. That's really, really cool. And yeah, I'm glad we were able to get you back on, and hopefully we can have you back on again to talk. I want to talk at some point about restorative justice. I think that that's a really,
yes. That's
a really exciting topic. So,
and that's an important topic for us to have in this, in our community, in our, you know, progressive, liberal, whatever, like we need a path to redemption and to have productive conversations and what that looks like. So, yep.
Next time with Parker McMullen Bushman, we will be talking about restorative justice, for sure.
Yes.
For sure. All right. Well, I have to hop off. I've got laundry that's been waiting for me in my shared laundry room in my building. But thanks for hanging out. And yeah, it's good to see you.
Thanks, everyone who stopped by. All right.
I mean, she's great, right? That's Parker. She knew about the topic. She had good takes. She's great. Yeah, that's a wild thing, you know, and I really don't know what to do about it. I don't know what to do about the fact that, like, such a big portion of the voting block is like voting on issues that they just fundamentally don't understand. And again, you know, if anyone out there is like, are you maybe mischaracterizing this, like, just to further drive it home, I want to read the tweets that Christopher Rufo wrote, where he kind of outlined very specifically the plan with critical race theory and the reason why they want to recodify it and utilize it the way that they've been utilizing it. So this is the actual tweet that most people reference when they talk about the time where Christopher Rufo kind of just like announced out loud what he was trying to do and what he was hoping to do with critical race theory and where what he has actually been successful in doing. So he tweeted, he said, "We have successfully frozen their brand, critical race theory, into the public conversation and are steadily driving up negative perceptions. We will eventually turn it toxic as we put all of the various cultural insanities under that brand category. The goal is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and immediately think critical race theory. We have decodified the term and will recodify it to annex the entire range of cultural constructions that are unpopular with Americans." I mean, like, when you watch a movie and the villain takes time to outline their plan to the hero and you go, that's unrealistic, just remember these tweets from Christopher Rufo. Next time you're like, oh, come on, why would they outline their entire plan in such meticulous detail? Just remember these tweets the next time you think that Christopher Rufo went, here's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to make critical race theory mean anything we want it to mean that we want to get rid of. And that's the goal. The plan is for us to recodify this term to mean anything that is convenient for us to galvanize our voting base against. Just said it in as clear of terms as he possibly could have said it. And that's what they're doing. I guess the question is, like, how do we get people to know that and to know that they are voting on a slogan that's been sold to them, an idea that's been sold to them that is just wildly inaccurate and not even remotely what they've been sold to think that it is. And even the thing that they've been sold to think that it is racist. They've been sold to think that it's this thing that's going to like make white kids uncomfortable in school. Like that's a fundamentally white supremacist thing to give a shit about. Like, I don't want white kids to be uncomfortable learning about race in school, you know? So anyway, just a thing that I think the conversation was good. I'm glad Parker came on the show, but I kind of sit here going, I have no idea what to do about these people. Anyway, I got to get my tooth fixed, dude. Got to call the dentist in the morning. Hey, you put a crown on my tooth not 6 months ago, and I paid for the good one too. I paid for there were two options of which crown I could get on. I could get like a kind of shoddier one or the nicer one. I paid for the nice one, and that shit just popped off. So what the heck? We gotta get this fixed. That's the show. Thanks again to Parker. Go follow Parker if you don't already at QueenWork on Instagram and TikTok, KWEENWERK, and check out the Inclusive Guide as well. Parker's a cool little app. That's a really cool thing. Okie dokie. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or by going to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. My music is mixed and mastered, and this podcast is mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music. Go to themarmalademusic.com. Tell Chris that you heard his work over here and that you want to work with him on your audio project, and he'll give you 20% off of your first project. Themarmalademusic.com. Tell him I sent you for 20% off your first project. Hell of a deal. Go do that. Okie dokie. Patreon.com/AustinArcher if you want to join there and support this show and support all the content that I make. Thank you so much to my Patreon patrons. Love you all. Your support, it just means the world to me. I just can't say it enough. Okay. All right. Take care of your teeth. Take care of each other. Next time you hear someone complaining about critical race theory, ask them if they know what it is. And when they obviously display to you that they don't, maybe take something from this podcast and say, it's actually this. Did you know that? And then maybe look up that tweet from Christopher Rufo and read that to them and see if that does anything. All right. We'll see you next week. Love you so much. Bye-bye.